Thank you all for coming. I know there's a lot of competition in this slot. It's been a very exciting conference, a lot of great panels to go to. My name is Colin Kinnebrew. I'm the climate and environment reporter at New York Focus, a newsroom that was founded in 2020 to cover New York State politics. We're the only nonprofit newsroom covering the state, and I'm thrilled to be hosting this panel. So before we get started, can I just get a quick show of hands? How many people in the room report for national outlets? How many people in the room report for local outlets? How many people in the room report for state outlets? All right, great. And maybe we have international reporters in the room too. But yeah, of course, this panel is focusing on the State House and climate policy that gets set at that level. I hope it'll be sort of an encouraging panel coming against a pretty bleak backdrop in our industry. So just going to say a few words to kind of set the scene, and then we'll get into the Q&A. So we've all seen the stats about the decline of local news. Pew reported that from 2004 to 2020, more than 2,000 newspapers shut down nationally. A lot of those are local papers, of course. The newsrooms that have hung on have slashed their staffs. Local reporting has taken a hard hit, but so has state-level coverage. The number of State House reporters dropped by more than a third in about a decade, 2003 to 2014. In speaking from the perspective of New York, the Times Union, which is sort of the paper of record in Albany, lost about half its staff in that same period, the last 20 years or so. That said, things have rebounded a little bit in the last, I'd say, 5 to 10 years. There are now slightly more State House reporters than there were in 2014, and that's in large part thanks to new nonprofit outlets. We've got a couple of them represented here on the stage: Cal Matters, the State's Newsroom, and others, including, of course, my outlet, New York Focus, the Texas Tribune as well, and many more across the country. And of course, we still have some of our legacy newspapers going strong and keeping the spotlight on the State House. So some of the trends are hopefully going back in the right direction, or at least, you know, balancing out the bad trends of the last decade or two. The reason we're all here, the reason this is so important, is that states obviously have a huge amount of power over our lives. And I think a lot of people don't always realize that what's going on in their state capital is super, super important, and how it trickles down to, you know, their day-to-day lives. So I think that's what we all cover, and that's what we're all here to talk about. And, you know, of course, that spans every aspect of our lives, but climate and environmental issues being a huge part of that. Energy, policy, just every aspect. Climate adaptation, mitigation. So with all of that in mind, I'm excited to introduce our panel. To my left is Julie Cart, the environment reporter at Cal Matters, a nonpartisan and nonprofit news organization covering California. Based in L.A., right, Julie? You're based in L.A., rather. Jennifer Solis is an environment and energy reporter for the Nevada Current, a nonprofit news outlet focused on state-level policy in the state's newsroom network, and she's attending the SCJ conference as a 2023 diversity fellow. And then all the way to my left is Aaron Jordan, an investigative reporter at the Gazette in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. The Gazette is one of Iowa's leading papers, and I learned yesterday is employee-owned, which is very cool, a little bit different than a lot of the corporate-owned newsrooms. No shade, sorry. So I'm very excited to have the three of you here on the panel. I wanted to start off by kind of setting the scene of, you know, talk a little bit. Can you each give us the lay of the land of, like, what do climate politics look like in your state? What is the kind of attitude of your state leadership? I think we've got one Republican-run state, we've got one Democratic-run state, Nevada's divided government. Tell us a little bit about, give us a lay of the land of, like, what are climate politics like in your state? And what's the biggest battle right now? Like, what's the biggest fight that's happening right now in your state house over climate policy? So let's start with you, Julie.
You want me to start?
Yeah.
Okay. Good morning, everyone. Well, California is deeply blue. I mean, there's no tinge of red anywhere. While there's debate, everyone is pretty much in lockstep. We're a place where our residents make it very clear through polling, through voting, through bond measures that they're very concerned about environmental issues. And we have them. You know, we have 1,000 miles of coast, so we have sea level rise issues that are today happening. We have a wildfire crisis, which is not only denuding the state and causing water quality issues, it's a huge healthcare problem. An ongoing drought, and then, of course, a winter of a deluge. So we have it all, so we're quite proud. We're disaster prone. But the state, there's no problem prying money out of Sacramento. So if you're talking about what the issues are, California wants to be a leader. We're annoying because we beat our chests constantly in this regard. You know, look at us for California's policies on a number, for example, tailpipe emissions and electric vehicles are the de facto federal policies just because of the kind of critical mass of California's both population, the economy, things like that. So it's a very, very active discussion, and really it comes down to how we're splitting the money up. And just as one aside, because there is a cap and trade program for carbon, to reduce carbon in California, there's a buttload of money. There's a huge, huge pile of dough that goes to mitigating current environmental problems, to paying for programs that would be nice but not attainable, and things like that. So we are the fifth largest economy in the world. There's a lot of money. There's a lot of philanthropic and grant money available in the state. So I think. It's something I should have done, but since I don't cover this specifically, but I think there's getting close to several billion dollars being spent on different environmental programs over a long period of time. But there are a lot of problems to address as well. But there's very little pushback. Very little pushback against the science. And if you're a Republican and you don't like these, the way these things go, it's not healthy to have this kind of incredible dominance of one party. But the Republicans just stand on the side and complain, but they don't get to have too much of a say or sway. So it's one way all the way. So it's quite unique in that regard.
I cover Nevada, as you can see in my name, Nevada Current. And the biggest tension for us is water. Nevada is the driest state in the nation.
Bring the mic a little closer. Thanks.
One of our favorite phrases is whiskey is for drinking and water is for fighting. It's also gaining a lot of tension from clean energy transition. 85% of Nevada is public lands, BLM-owned lands, which means a lot of it is undeveloped. But now, because of the clean energy transition, a lot of that land is being developed, and there is a lot of tension there from tribes, rural locals who, you know, live in that part of the world because they like it that way. And it's a real issue for many tribes, too, because many clean energy projects that are being developed are on unceded sacred sites. There was a lot of treaty violations back in our history in the United States. And so a lot of public land is traditional tribal land. And they don't get a lot of say on where these clean energy development projects are placed, which creates a lot of tension. So there's a huge environmental justice aspect to state-level climate politics. Tribes are governments. They have the right to government-to-government consultation, which is skidded a lot by the Bureau of Land Management. And that is something we have to watch out for. On the state level, as we go through the clean energy transition. And that's one of the biggest lessons I hope you come away from this. It's a big tension spot in Nevada. Water and climate justice.
So my newspaper is in eastern Iowa, and a lot of agriculture is our primary industry, so a lot of the environmental aspects we're covering there is the impact of farming on our water, on our topsoil, just on a lot of different things in the state. I would say the hottest issue right now, there are three proposals for CO2 pipelines through the state. They would collect CO2 from the 40 or so ethanol plants that Iowa has. It's a very pure CO2, so it's desirable for this sort of process. Two of the pipelines would take the CO2 to underground sequestration sites in Illinois, and one would go to an underground site in North Dakota. And landowners largely they hate the idea. They hate the idea that the state might allow eminent domain to be used for the pipelines. And yet there's so much money available in tax credits for these proposals that you have the government, the largely Republican government, kind of supporting these proposals at the same time their constituents, many of them Republicans, are deeply opposed. So that's provided a lot of fodder for us to write about.
Great. Lots of lively fights over every aspect of clean energy policy going on across the country. I want to pick up on an issue we heard about yesterday at the plenary and that Jennifer brought up as well, which is this issue of renewables and land use. Where do we put all the stuff that we need for the clean energy transition? And Aaron, I want to start with you here. I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about how the politics on this are shifting. My sense is, it's maybe surprising to people that Iowa, which I believe is a fully Republican-run state, at least, or has a Republican trifecta, has the highest share of renewables in the country, right?
It's number two in the country for wind energy. I think we generate like 60-some percent of our electricity through wind. Growing amount of solar, but it's primarily wind. But I think that, like a lot of states, I think we've seen that tension between some of the utility scale solar projects and wind, are now getting more pushback. As I've heard in other places, the opposition campaigns are becoming more, sophisticated and mobilized. So, I think that's been interesting to see. One thing with all the renewables in Iowa, we've seen a lot of data centers locate in the state because they can get cheap energy. I've written a few stories about cryptocurrency mining, farms opening, in areas served by rural electric cooperatives because they can get just like dirt cheap energy. And the people in town have no idea what the, building is that's set up out in the country. They don't know it's just full of servers, mining for Bitcoin. And then, that's been kind of interesting to explain that.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting. I feel like some of the states that are putting up the most renewables, like Iowa and Texas, are also getting a flood of new demand for that cheap energy, mostly in the form of crypto. But just to stay on Iowa for a second, you wrote a story about how this is kind of increasingly reflecting this partisan divide, right? This sort of culture war that, is becoming more polarized, that Republicans are becoming more straightforwardly opposed to clean energy where they might have been, more supportive earlier. Is that right?
Well, I think, I don't know if this is something that happened just recently. There was money available through the EPA that you could get, Iowa could get, and I think all states is the same amount, up to $3 million for climate change planning. And Iowa decided not to apply for it. So just leaving money on the table, even though Iowa's greenhouse gas emissions from agriculture are like the second highest in the country, and the state has no greenhouse gas reduction plan. So how about take some money from the feds and do that? But they said no. So that, and I think that's, we have a Republican governor I think there's just a lot of concern how that's going to reflect on the big ag in the state.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Jennifer, you mentioned that a lot of these debates are also playing out in the desert. I think you wrote about a geothermal plant, for example, that was, you know, got its permit revoked. Tell us a little bit. It seems like, you know, when we're covering this stuff, there are some legitimate debates between, as you know, we've been talking about all weekend, you know, conservation, preserving biodiversity, respecting local sovereignty, all of these factors you have to take into account. And balancing that with this need for like a huge, huge, just staggering build out of renewable energy if we're going to get anywhere close to meeting our national, state, and local climate goals. So tell us a little bit about how that's played out in Nevada.
So the story he's referencing is very interesting and got a lot of national headlines. Burning Man sued a geothermal company called Ormat for a plan to build a geothermal plant in like a mile from a small town called Gerlach, Nevada. The town is sort of a gateway town to Burning Man, which is a huge festival I'm sure we're all aware of. And that got a lot of national play. You know, here's Burning Man, a music festival, suing to cancel clean energy. But on the state level, it's actually a much more complicated story. Gerlach is a small rural town. 200 people live there. And they have drought problems just like everywhere in Nevada. It's the driest state in the nation again. And geothermal, report after report has shown that geothermal causes the groundwater to reduce. That is a huge issue in our state that has no water practically. This small town relies on that groundwater. So they are the ones who really pushed for this lawsuit, which threatens the vitality of their town. It's an ecotourism town. It depends a lot on its hot water springs, on the ecotourism that Burning Man brings. And the topic of clean energy is very complicated in that town. The geothermal plant was also sued by the Summit Lake Paiute Tribe, which their reservation lies a few miles from this area as well. And they have a real fear that the more this clean energy transition happens throughout Nevada, the more springs, which many are sacred to many tribes, will be dried up by these clean energy projects. I'm sure if you look at your own states, there is a lot of environmental justice issues with these clean energy projects. You know, it's more complicated than you'd think, looking at national headlines. But luckily, as state reporters, we can really dig into the politics of energy. You know, environmental journalism is politics journalism. It's the same thing. Which we see on the state level quite frequently. So this permit was revoked by the Washoe County Board of Commissioners. It was revoked by Republican and Democratic commissioners because, you know, people vote for them. And if people find out that they allowed a permit to go through, which could dry up the water of this small town that depends on it, they would be voted out. Again, these are politicians at the end of the day. So how people receive this clean energy will be reflected by the politicians in that local area. And a lot of these permits for clean energy, at least on federal land, needs to be approved on the federal level, the state level, and the local level, which means there's a lot of layers for it to be stopped, for it to continue, for there to be conflict. If you watch your county commission board meetings, a lot of these big energy projects get approved or denied through that process. So state level reporting is very important for the national, you know, coverage of clean energy transition. And that is that story. It has a lot of opposition. And it's also, you know, geothermal is one of the better clean energy systems. It has a smaller footprint. It's cleaner. It needs less infrastructure. The supply of energy really is endless. Even if it does deplete the ground level, it does last forever. So I'd say, you know, keep your eye for that clean energy development in your state. Who's opposing it? Why? What are the details of why they're opposing it? It's not just because they're against clean energy or they're climate deniers. There's a lot of layers to it that we need to acknowledge.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree with so much of what you said there. You know, again, that so many of these big national things that we're all talking about are filtering down and really getting decided often at the state level, and of course with local input, but often in these you know, public utility or public service commissions, those kinds of meetings that I think a lot of people aren't following these days. So I hope many of you here are. And I want to pick up on this tension. I mean, just stay on this tension between kind of local control and, you know, the kind of big bad state that is sometimes seen as, you know, trying to push a certain project or other. Julie, you mentioned that California is overwhelmingly Democratic, as New York is. But still, we've seen these debates play out over and over. And even, you know, Democrats who might be supportive of clean energy goals broadly, when it comes to citing a project in a, you know, in their district, come out and say, hey, whoa, we're not so sure about that. And even, you know, state senators who passed, like, there was a policy that was mentioned in the plenary yesterday, sort of citing permitting reform that passed in New York, that, you know, is very popular, has been cited as a national example. But you have even Democrats joining with Republicans to say, hey, no, this is overriding local control. And so that tension is still very live. I know you've covered that a little bit in California. So can you tell us a bit about how it's played out there with Newsom's recent energy plan?
Newsom has a plan for everything. Yes, it's a Democratic state, but trying to get Democrats to get in line is like herding cats, so there's that. The other thing, just as we are, you know, so virtuous and clean and pure as Californians, there's a huge element of NIMBYism, particularly when you're talking about clean energy development. And we have a host of state laws. This is not pie in the sky. We will be 100% electric off fossil fuels. We will have 100% electric vehicles. You may not buy a new car in 2035 that's not that has ICE, internal combustion engine. So I think what Jennifer was talking about, I think the word, the transition to clean energy, there's both the transition itself and then there's the just transition side. So if you are a Democrat from our Central Valley, which is this little splash of pink and red, if you want to look at the spectrum, we're the fifth largest oil producer. That's where the oil comes from. That's where our oil patch is. Because of that, it's in conflict with ag, because you're talking about subsidence. You know, there are parts of the valley that's 35 feet lower than it used to be because the groundwater and our aquifers are depleted. So what you have, you're a Democrat there, you have to be in favor of oil and gas, which is being phased out in the state and under attack from their point of view. So there is a transition. That's where you get that expression, just transition. Are we retraining these people? You cannot throw people out on their ear. These are actually quite good paying jobs and in an area where you bend over and pick food. So they're pretty good jobs. The other difference where there's conflict is if you start drilling down and you look at what the new economy is and the so-called blue or green economy with renewables, if you're at a utility scale power plant out in the desert, it's a guy driving around in a pickup truck and clipboard. The employment is in the construction, and the construction trades in California are hot and cold. They come out against renewable energy because there's no jobs on the outside. Wind energy. California now has going to build, or the feds are going to build out in the deep ocean, two wind projects. Everyone's against them because no one's making any dough from them. And we also have quite a lot of regulations that prevent onshoring anything from even federal waters onto the state. That's a way to stop oil drilling, because we have offshore drilling in California. So the tension comes even when you are supposedly in lockstep politically. Politics are local. So in the northern part of the state, these are counties that have tried again and again to secede from the rest of California. They're very different in Humboldt County than in Santa Monica, completely. 40 million people, and we're not the same. It's not, it's not a monolith. So even though there are clear policies and what seems to be clear, at least majority support to this transition, there are pockets of very loud, very belligerent, or very powerful opposition, and even in the Democratic Party. So it's not so clear cut. And Nevada's 87% fed. We're 47% federal land. That's just the western, the western mosaic. And so we have no say. 20 million acres in the Mojave is all blanketed with utility scale solar. Is that good? Is that bad? I don't know. If you live out there, if you're those desert tribes that want access to that property, if you care about a T&E species, threatened and endangered species, that's not so cool. Transmission lines that need to support that, that's a utility corridor that's a mile wide. I mean, it goes on and on and on. So green energy, it's here and it's going to be dominant, but everything has, there's a downside to everything, or a price to pay, or, imprint. And that is quite clear. And that's the point of tension.
Right. There are trade-offs to everything. I think you touched on one point, which is really important, which is that, California is gigantic. So, of course, it's not a monolith. There are so many, fifth largest economy, 40 million people or however many. We have, New York is similar, but even within smaller states, there's so much diversity, so many different communities. And I think in that way, we actually, as sort of state-level reporters, face a challenge that, many national reporters do, which is like, how are we, trying to cover as many of these communities as we can, while keeping our eye on that bigger picture. I have a bunch more questions here about, different climate issues I'm sure we're all working on, but I actually want to pause and ask a kind of more general question, which is, how dysfunctional is your state government? Like, New York, I feel like, we're this democratic state, especially on climate. We're always talking about how we're climate leaders, a lot of friendly, not so friendly competition with California and Washington and whatnot. But when it comes to like actually implementing stuff and how the government works, like so much of it is just it's really not transparent. I have a hard time, really hard time getting foils back. Like right now we're getting on 4 weeks past the budget deadline where, this $200 plus billion in spending is getting hashed out by, it used to be three men in a room, now it's two women and one man, but the point is the same, it's super opaque, right? So I'm curious how true that is of your state's, and just one more thing on the transparency point, we have the latest reporter to join our staff came up from Florida, and every time he's like, oh, so how do I find this, piece of information, this data, this contract or whatever, I'm like, it's really hard. You have to go through some crazy website and you might never actually find it. And like, if you foil for it, they're probably not actually going to get back to you for months. And he's like, say what you will about Florida, like libertarianism or whatever, but like they love, Sunshine State, they love transparency. Everything is online. So I'm just curious if you want to everyone wants to talk a little bit about process, interacting with your state government, kind of how accessible are politicians, documents that you need, how transparent are things? So maybe we can come this way this time, starting with Aaron.
Well, one of the things, and I'm sure this is not unique, toward the end of the legislative session, you have these evenings going until like 2, 3, 4 a.m., and the reporters are trying to, bleary-eyed, like, okay, now something else is passing, something else. Oh, this is a new thing, trying to keep up with that. So as someone that I don't work physically in the state house, I feel like my role to support those reporters is to take the issues out a little bit and to do more extended coverage. There was a bill two sessions ago that they were going to make it really hard for entities for people to donate their land for conservation, to donate it to like a foundation or a county or something like that. And they had like 300 people turn up at a public hearing, and like it was like at 8 a.m. and they couldn't fit in the room and everything. But as that worked through, that's where I felt like I had an opportunity to do some climate reporting on that and look at how Iowa's only like 3% of the land in Iowa is public land. That's such a huge difference from what you guys have. And so much of it is tied up in crops, especially corn. And the Farm Bureau and other organizations like it, they don't want any of that land to be turned into public land. They will even say that outright. Like, even if it's just would get us to 4%, they don't want that. So I guess getting back to Colin's question, just about, you know, I would say that right now it's frustrating, I think, for some parties because there is such Republican dominance that they really don't have to listen to any other points of view, and things are happening in the middle of the night, and it's really hard for the public to stay abreast of that.
As Colin mentioned, Nevada has a divided government, but the government is surprisingly functional with being a divided government. We all understand that we need water and we need to take care of our water. We've understood that for 20 years. Our water infrastructure is top in the nation because we've always been in drought. We all understand that that is something we have to protect, and the bills that go through legislature to protect water rights and groundwater are surprisingly, bipartisan. So right now there's a bill going through legislature, SB 176, to pay water users to voluntarily retire their water rights. Nevada has committed water rights 1.5 times more than the 2 million acre feet available of groundwater over allocation of water. And we all understand that that needs to be fixed. Because people have water rights that are real on paper, but the water is not physically there, and we need to make those people whole. We all understand that, Democrats, Republicans. That's one of the things with environmental topics on the state level, is that politicians understand that that is something we have to agree on, we have to fix. You see that with the Colorado River negotiations. You know, you have a very Republican state, Arizona, negotiating with a very liberal state, California, and they know that they just have to get it done, that there's no other option. And you really see that in Nevada because we're kind of ahead of the game in what climate change is going to look like for the rest of you.
You want me to do that?
Yeah.
We have a Slack channel at CalMatters that's devoted only and exclusively to this agency refused to answer my question. I have a Public Records Act thing. You know, it goes on and on and on. We have a lawyer, and there are a lot of nonprofit legal groups that will give you a First Amendment lawyer, or you can ask advice. You should really look into that because that makes a difference. I call and, you know, I'm outraged and, you know, righteous, but we send an email or a letter with letterhead, Esquire, and we demand this and we cite such and such. It makes a big difference. People have been talking about it a lot, and I would, if to the extent that you have a press corps covering the State House as an organization, you should definitely mobilize that, because that's happened in Sacramento. For example, the governor does not speak to local media or state media. Oh, if you're from the New York Times or CBS, he's got time for you, but he does not talk to us because he has ambitions and he's got nice hair and stuff like that. So it's obviously, as the person who's leading the state, whose policies are being reflected in the state, you would, you know, like to run this stuff past him. So that's a real dysfunction. You guys are a part-time legislature?
Yes, yeah. Once every other year.
So we're full-time, extra full-time. And I think that helps in terms of access, process. Things don't get dropped and picked up unless there's a different reason. And the last thing, a lot of people, thankfully, I don't live in Sacramento. I do mean that in a derogatory way. I'm not physically at the State House. I cover my topics, and I'm also a projects writer, so I'm at a remove, and I'm not walking those corridors every day. But people are saying that, and I know it's true from my reporting, COVID changed everything, as we all know, in every way that's imaginable, but the idea of not working in an office for state employees and not being available in person. We don't get phone numbers anymore. I can go on sites for agencies that I'm responsible for covering, and there's no way to contact anyone except for, you know, info at, you know, and you're thinking, is there a person there? So there's a laxity now in the feeling from these folks that they have to be present, that we always are a pain in the ass, and that's, you know, that's who we are, but there is a requirement. You are a public employee. It's really, really hard. And public records requests, it's absolutely standard that they wait to the last minute, and then I worked on something where this happened. And, you know, I finally had to grab someone, you know, in person and fly somewhere and say, is there a reason you're not giving me this data? You know, and then I found out what it was, and then I wrote the story. But, it's functional kind of writ large, but there's a lot of breakdowns, particularly in making information available to media. And I also think that a big problem in a lot of states is the money. When you have this huge bureaucracy, these websites, they're critical to all of us. It's how we do our work. And they're crap. You know, the information is old, you know more than that, and they don't have the facility to update them or to upgrade them. And when they do, the whole thing shuts down for a year and a half. And, you know, our oil and gas regulator still does everything on paper. And I was looking at some documents, and it was on the back of an envelope. You know, it's not the Gettysburg Address. This is really critical. What's going on here? And they are saying, "Oh, we're digitizing that." No, you're not. You know. So a lot of it is opacity because they want to hide, and they don't want this stuff to be seen. A lot of it is, to be fair, probably just the usual bureaucracy. Oh, you know, nobody. Dave is supposed to do it, but he's on leave, and you know, stuff like that. So it's really bad.
Good to know we're not alone in that. Okay, I have about a million more questions I could ask, but I think actually the best thing might be to open it up to you all. I think we have a lot to learn from each other, so maybe we can dive right into audience Q&A. And I'm sure you've heard this a million times by now. SEJ members get priority. Please identify yourselves. And I'm going to repeat your question into the microphone for the recording. I think that's everything. All right. Erin?
I'm Erin Douglas from the Texas Tribune. And one thing that I have been noticing in our state capital is with, like, more political polarization, climate change getting wrapped up into the political polarization, what Texas is doing is looking at California and being like, we don't want to be California, and then they'll write a law that is, like, the anti-California version of that law. Like, something going through right now where it would ban restrictions on products that would increase greenhouse gas emissions. So, like, if a local city wants to ban something that's fueled by fossil fuels, they would not be able to do that if this passes. So I guess my question for you all would be, like, what are you seeing in terms of, like, just reactionary legislation in the climate change realm, and how have you seen the climate change issue be polarized in your state legislatures?
Okay, how have you all seen climate being polarized in your state legislatures?
I guess, you know, when I was talking about with the CO2 pipelines, we've seen that a lot, in terms of who people are listening to. Are they listening to their constituents, or are they listening to money? I think lots of times things are worded differently by, you know, different sides. Like, we don't see as much use of certain phrases, like even climate change. It might be like, you know, we're going to talk about soil loss, you know, rather than talking about just like the toll that climate change is taking on our land. So, I mean, we've seen a lot of that, and I think if they need to change the phrases of it in order to pass something, then go for it, you know. But that's, I mean, I guess that's how I've seen it in Iowa.
In Nevada, because it's a huge state, there's only really two real cities, Reno and Las Vegas, and the rest is just small rural towns and public land. So the large conflict you see there is the rural and urban divide. Right now in the legislature, we have a bill that was proposed by the Southern Nevada Water Authority, the top water authority for Southern Nevada, to ban septic tanks because they waste a lot of water and the water can't get recycled. It goes straight into the ground. It doesn't go back into our aquifer system, can't be sent back to Lake Mead. It's water that's gone. And a lot of rural towns operate on septic tanks. You know, they don't have the infrastructure that goes to a water recycling plant. And a lot of rural Nevadans are very against the law because they have a septic tank, and how are they going to get rid of it? And what if they have to buy it? They have to build an entire infrastructure to use municipal water. While the cities do not have that problem. That's a very complicated, almost impossible situation to fix, because 75% of the population of Nevada lives in Southern Nevada, in Las Vegas. So it's a huge majority that would benefit from saving this water against, like, these rural populations that are wasting water because of just the system, the infrastructure that they're stuck with. So that's the sort of conflict you'll see in Nevada legislature. It's the rural and urban divide, and usually it's not that politics-based. It's more utilitarian, like why this is not going to work for rural Nevada and why it would work for, you know, one of the two cities that we have.
Yeah, Aaron, we've seen that too. What you're talking about. This is playground stuff. Our governor is doing it with DeSantis in Florida. So when he does something, we affirm the woman's right to have an abortion pill. We will not only not ban books, we will, you know, promote books. You know, please read Catcher in the Rye. It's very silly. So I think there's a difference. I would expect policy to be politicized. I mean, there's probably some Latin root word in there that puts them together. What we don't want, and what California tries not to do and doesn't allow anymore, is the politicization of science. So everything is backed by that, we don't discuss it anymore. There's no, on the other hand, no, it doesn't work like that. So we're really good with blue ribbon commissions, and, you know, the California Commission of Science and Technology put out the, so everybody's on some kind of committee. I'm the last person in the state is not on a committee for something. And that's the basis for the policy. And not that there's not politics in that or partisanship, but it gives cover to some politicians who might be against something. But when there's a person with glasses and a lab coat and says, you have to do this because of X, and I've studied it, it's pretty hard to counter that. And I think that's a good way to couch these debates and to base them in science, if to the extent that we trust scientists, and we know it changes and opinions change. But it takes it out. It takes a little bit of the conflict out of it, and it provides cover for everybody, and that's part of politics too.
Yeah, I'll actually add a few words on another layer of this that I've encountered, which is pushback. I mean, it's a version of the rural-urban thing a little bit, but pushback at the county level to certain policies, for example. So the... I would say the biggest debate right now in New York is around whether we're going to ban fossil fuels in buildings. You know, versions of this are obviously playing out everywhere. And banning the bans. We have a Democratic trifecta. Everything gets decided by Democrats at the state level. But that's really not true of a lot of our counties. Nothing is final, but set this up a little bit. In 2019, we passed this big climate law that set these ambitious high-level targets of like how much we're going to cut emissions, how much we're going to transition to renewables, all of those things. There was a expert panel that had to hash out how exactly we were going to do that. 3 years later, they've finished that. They finished that in December. And so now we're getting to the point where actually, you know, the legislature has no more excuses. They have, you know, it's time to act on these things. So the politics are getting a lot more heated. And part of the climate plan is, yes, ban gas in new buildings and start phasing out, replacements of fossil fuel boilers, heating, all that stuff in 2030. There was a revolt from the counties, especially in western New York. So, you know, the upstate, downstate is kind of the classic, you know, divide in New York, maybe overstated, but it's how a lot of people see things. A lot of the counties in western New York, they all drafted these pretty much identical resolutions. It started with Erie County, and then some of the same language got picked up by another county, and then, you know, copy-pasted resolutions saying, no, like, Don't touch our gas stoves, essentially, and playing into these sort of national culture war debates, but that is trickling into local government, and so fueling that kind of partisan thing, even in states where there is, you know, full democratic control. So I thought that was kind of an interesting example, and counties are another level of government that we haven't really talked about, that, you know, I certainly feel like I need to pay more attention to, if only because as a kind of barometer of, like, you know, politics more broadly and across different parts of the state. Okay, let's take another question. All right, I'm going to go to the back in the green.
Hi, I'm Rachel. I'm a reporter at Boise State Public Radio. I have a question for Jennifer about the renewable energy initiative. Do you think that
So I would say there's more. So Nevada is a very business-friendly state. There's a lot of money to be made in renewable energies. It's not all for the good of humanity. You know, companies are set to make a lot of money from this. Utilities actually can only make money from infrastructure they build, not by rate increases. So they're incentivized to build more of this renewable energy, to build new infrastructure and make more money from ratepayers. So in Nevada, there's more legislation to incentivize clean energy built and lithium mining. There's a lot of money to be made from lithium. Nevada has one of the largest deposits in the United States. We actually have the only functioning lithium mine in the United States. One big project that's attracted a lot of conflict is called the Thacker Pass Lithium Mine, and it's going to be the largest lithium mine in the United States when it's finally built, and the third largest in the whole world. And that will make Nevada a lot of money. And at the end of the day, that's what politicians want. They want to say, we made new jobs, we've improved the economy, we've diversified the economy. So there's a large push for these clean energy projects, despite a lot of them being in conflict with what tribes want, what rural communities want. And sorry, repeat the second part of your question.
I just wanted to understand what you meant when you said that the project that
Right, right. The approval process. Right. So,
sorry, and I was meant to repeat the question, which I forgot to do into the mic. So I'm just going to reiterate. It sounds like in Idaho, for example, and in a lot of cases where it's public lands, it's mostly up to the federal government. So yeah, tell us more about the roles at different levels of government.
Right. So if something's going to be built on BLM land, it does need federal approval. It needs to go through the environmental impact statement process, the NEPA process. But there's also, you know, whether it's on public land or not, it's within a county. You know, it's in Washoe County, it's in Clark County, and it needs to get county approval. So the county boards, they're your Clark County Board of Commissioners, your Washoe County Board of Commissioners, you know, the county level, they also have the right to approve or deny projects that are going to be built in their jurisdiction. They need to supply like air quality permits. So there's a lot of different permits that need to be approved for a project to be built. Water permits. You know, the company needs to show that they're not going to pollute the water. If they do pollute the water, that they have some method to stop the water from going into the ground, the polluted water. The company needs to prove that they're not going to ruin the air quality that above a level that's federally permitted or state permitted. So these projects do have to go through a lot of layers, and you can catch them, you know, before they even get to like the federal approval process. If you're like checking in on your local governments who have the right to approve or deny some of these permits. Again, the story I wrote about the geothermal plant in Washoe County, they, you know, got a permit approved through the county, but then because of so much pushback, it was revoked, which they have the right to do with large projects.
Julie, did you want to add anything on this?
Are you okay with that answer? 'Cause,
no. All right, great. Okay, I'll take one over here. Yep.
I'm Connor. I'm at the Courier Journal in Louisville, and we're kind of in an interesting landscape where we have a deeply red legislature and a Democrat governor who's actually a pretty popular Democrat governor, including among Republicans. Many would say he's done that by staying fairly moderate on things, including climate change. And he's also in a re-election year. I'm wondering if any of you have examples in your states or others of governors kind of taking climate action against the current of their state legislature, and also if you have any ideas to how to approach maybe pressing the Kentucky governor on saying the words climate change, for example.
Okay, so the question is about whether you've seen examples of governors going against the grain of the legislature in your respective states when it comes to climate policy, and what might push Kentucky's governor to say the words climate change?
I have kind of like an interesting one. So Nevada just got its fourth national monument, the Aviqua Ame. That was a big push by the Moapa Band of Paiutes and the Fort McDermitt tribe to make that a national monument, considered a sacred site. It's featured in many of the creation beliefs of tribes in that region. And our Republican governor, you know, he's been governor for 2 months. This national monument designation has been in the process for 2 years. And he, you know, sent out a public statement about how the government was like stealing Nevada land to make this national monument and that nobody wants it to happen. Just very clueless about how there was a huge bipartisan push for this national monument. And it seems it was just sort of reactionary, which I suppose you get in a divided government or a new governor who's, you know, divided from the party that most of their legislature is to, like, show that they have some influence, some power, and they do some pushing around. So I'm surprised that your governor hasn't said the word climate change, honestly.
I specifically am referring to our floods in the summer when it was very clearly something that would have become more likely and more disastrous because of climate change, and was very careful to avoid.
Mm-hmm. I would say we don't have that sort of situation with the Republicans controlling all three parts of the government. But I think what I would do is just maybe in the off season, you know, that's kind of between legislative sessions, try to see if you could get some time with him and, like, you know, and, you know, just even express that you want to talk about some of these things. I don't know how open he would be to that, to spending a little time, you know, talking about those sorts of things. I think a couple things that we do in Iowa to try to force the governor to say something sometimes is we will we'll file the open records requests and ask for communications so we can see what our staff is saying. I had a time where I filed an open records request that hadn't been responded to for 60 days. And then the governor was going to speak at like a 150th park anniversary. And I went there and, you know, it was like out in the just boonies of Iowa. And, you know, she was not expecting any press. And then afterwards, she was going to walk away and go canoeing with her husband and grandchildren. And I started approaching her and asking her a question. And she was like, no press, no press, no press. Like, she just hadn't thought that any media would come to this thing. And but I kind of shouted my questions. Why isn't your office responding to our open records requests? And all these public who had come for this positive event heard this, you know, and I think it was embarrassing for her because I'm walking back to my car and her media guy calls me, who had been dodging me this request for 60 days. And he was like, what is it you're looking for? And I'm like, Pat, you know, like, we've had this conversation. And I had the records that day. So sometimes don't diminish the impact of just, like, kind of trying the records request, but being in their face a little bit if they are just dodging you.
That's an amazing tactic. I love that. You want to add anything? All right. What do we got? Jean Jacket? So how do you find the data when the data isn't there, when your state isn't studying things that maybe it should be? If I may take moderator's privilege, one thing I've noticed, and it may not be true of every issue, but is that federal data can also be incredibly rich. I recently came across I forget which agency manages it. Maybe it's BLM, who we've heard a lot from this weekend. But an energy database where, you know, it maps wind farms down to the individual turbine, right? You can click on a wind turbine and it will tell you how many megawatts that's producing, you know. So, like, just incredible, incredible levels of detail in some federal data. Obviously, that doesn't get you everything, but I would suggest, you know, trying to mine that where you can when your state government isn't super responsive, so, or isn't studying things the way they should. What do people want to add on that? Yeah.
Go ahead. Oh, thank you. Thank you, Aaron. I'm going to go on a canoe trip and see what stories I can get. That's a great idea. It's so interesting that a state like Oklahoma, that gave us the Dust Bowl, that has one of the most important aquifers in the United States, doesn't know that. Sometimes stories are about the lack of data, because the old saw, you can't measure what you don't monitor. I mean, if you don't know how much water you have, how do you manage it? California does not measure groundwater, doesn't Anyone can, at the moment, there's a law coming up, but giving, right, Janet, lots of people time to get ready for it, but you can stick a straw in, and believe me, everyone's doing it. So it, to me, it's a story to say Oklahoma water officials in an ag state or a livestock state, how come you don't know how much water there is? And then put them in a position of saying, well, we don't measure it. The other thing when you're trying to find it, I did a story on this a long time ago on this epidemic of dead trees. And my editor, as all are, was very persnickety and said, okay, 160 million dead trees. How many trees are in California? And I, fuck, who knows that? And I started, I mean, it's, who would know that? And I was explaining to her, the only entity that knows that is Sierra Pacific, which is this huge lumber company, the largest landowner in the state, because they have an economic interest in knowing that. So for water, I would, if the state doesn't do that, sometimes there's a reason they don't want to know things, because then they're going to have to acknowledge, oh, shit, things are out of control, we don't have enough, or this guy's taking too much. But I would look at who has an economic interest in that water. And irrigators, local water districts, municipalities, and you're going to find big guzzlers. And, you know, I would do it that way, because if you don't, if it, you are more likely to have up-to-date, pertinent data if you've got a financial interest in something, because it's your dough. Otherwise, you know, so that might be a way to go. But I do think there's stories to be said that we don't, I can't, if you would like to know how much water Oklahoma has available, so would I, and we don't know. And isn't that a problem? And that's a, there's your paragraph, and call it a day, you know, kind of.
I just want to add that I agree with every panelist here. My editor likes to say that his favorite stories about the legislature is which bills are not going through the legislature. That itself is a story that honestly many people are interested in. They ask, why is that not happening? And, you know, are interested. And there is a lot of federal data on water for states. The U.S. Geological Survey tracks a lot of groundwater and aquifers. The U.S. Department of Agriculture, they release water reports from snowpacks and stream runoff. Yeah. Every, you know, month. And so, you know, if you can't get local data, definitely federal data will be there. And yeah, exactly that. Your water authorities will know how much water there is, how much water everyone's using, and the utility companies, again, because of that financial profit, they know how much is there. So you can try through those avenues. That's been useful in my reporting. And
yeah, I was just going to add on to that. And if you're worried about just like calling the utility and being like, so you answer this question. I mean, sometimes they put a shocking amount of information in their annual reports, like just companies. I've been really surprised. So that it can be a source of information. I also think universities sometimes are studying this and not always the universities in your state. You know, it may be a university somewhere else. And then also, if your aquifer stretches across multiple states, maybe another state's doing the data collection that would also be relevant.
So many great answers there. One last thing that comes to mind on that point, if I may, is also maybe less true for water. I don't know if every state regulates water utilities in the same way they do energy utilities. I know New York doesn't, but some might. But certainly on when it comes to energy, a lot of stuff that is not in like open data portals or somewhere where you can easily look up the data, it might be buried somewhere in the PSC docket or something like that. So familiarizing yourself with those, you know, sources, I feel like can be really useful too. All right. Okay. We got one right in the front here.
Hi, Liza Gross inside Climate News. This is for Jennifer. You mentioned in the beginning that a lot of public lands, are on unceded, homelands. A lot of sacred sites are going to be involved. And I'm wondering, if there's any mechanism for tribes to have a seat at the table when there are discussions about where renewable energy projects are going to be set.
So what mechanisms are there for tribes to get a seat at the table in siting renewable energy projects?
So they are supposed to have a seat at the table. They have the right to government consultation, again, because tribes are sovereign nations. They are a government. They're their own government. They have a government-to-government relationship with the United States, and they have the right to consultation under federal law. But Bureau of Land Management, which approves and denies these permits for these clean energy projects a lot of the time, kind of play fast and loose with that term. They'll send, you know, a single letter to one tribe in the area and say they've done their government-to-government consultation. You know, and a lot of these tribes don't have ready internet access. The switch in leadership is different, like, than the state's, you know, change in leadership. So maybe the past chair of the tribe got the letter, but not the new one. It's really, I can't say what the BLM's motive for doing that is, but it's not a great way to inform tribes, basically. And they can get away with it because it's a very general term, this government-to-government consultation and what it means. And when tribes challenge it, you know, in the courthouse, they lose oftentimes because BLM can say they've done consultation.
All right, one over here. I love this question. Where do you look for context and, you know, where to compare with other states? I feel like we get this a lot where we get really isolated in, you know, our state borders. So, yeah, I'd love to hear what everyone on the panel thinks about that.
So you're kind of talking about stuff on deadline or, you know, like a daily news cycle type story. I think sometimes it's hard to find the apples to apples comparisons like that when you need them quickly. What I fall back on if I need that is like different newsletters I subscribe to. They, like, if I'm writing about solar project that was denied or something like that, I remember seeing, oh, yeah, like Minnesota had something like that or Illinois had something like that. So I use those newsletters to try to find quick examples, and you may even be able to cite some information from another media outlet without even having to do an interview that day. I had a story this last year that that some of our large energy users who won't even define the companies that are part of their group, I assume it's like Facebook, Google, you know, these companies that have data centers in Iowa, they want to be able to buy their electricity on the open market instead of having to go through these investor-owned utilities based geographically in the state. But there's like four states that allow specifically large energy users to kind of have this open access. And so I did talk with the four other states, and it turned into a super interesting story. And it gave Iowa some context that for a concept that they had not, you know, that citizens hadn't heard about before. But that took a while. So I don't know how you do that, like in a, you know, kind of a quick turn. Do you have an idea?
Oh, hi, you just joined us. You just joined States Newsroom.
Can you tell us your name as well?
Yeah, Erica Bolstead. And we do a lot of those kinds of stories. And I'm pulling from different places and looking for trends. But yeah, that is 100% what we do. So I'm happy to, to chat.
I'll have a quick thing to say. Well, you're mentioning the word context, but sometimes it's reality check. So it's, we think we're great at this, but look at another state that's doing better, another country that's doing better. I mean, all you need to do is look at the European Union to look at how far behind the United States federally is in terms of a lot of laws. And it's true, Maine is its own little beast, but you can do per capita analyses. You can find another state. And, it's kind of standard journalism, the superlatives. Find the worst and the best and put yourself, rank yourself there. Of course, every state is so unique. We like to think so. But when you do per capita analyses, then that's apples to apples.
I talk a lot with regional nonprofits. They're actually very rich sources for information. They keep a lot of nonprofits or advocacy groups will keep track of a specific kind of bill. Like I was writing a story on our gas utility rates, and Western Resource Advocates have, immediate info on, well, this state costs more, this state costs less, this state has passed this legislation or that legislation. There are people out there who know more than you because they specifically focus on that, very niche topic. And building sources and knowing who has that information when you, need it is really useful.
That's so true. I think whether it's at the regional level or even national organizations, there are a lot of groups that put out state scorecards for whatever issue they're tracking, for example. So sometimes you can find those. Sometimes they're advocacy groups and you have to take what they say with a grain of salt. But, they might be the only ones who are actually out there compiling that data. And so it can give you a quick reference for comparing with other states. Okay, I think we've got, we're really close. Let's take one more over here. Any tips from the panel for looking, trying to find out who's behind bills?
I have one quick tip. Just if you, if your state legislature has a list of lobbyists and who their clients are, Iowa has that list online. But if not, you might request that. You could ask for all the names of the lobbyists, who their clients are, and contact information for the lobbyist.
I'd agree on that. Also, a lot of legislatures, you're a lawmaker and you have to report who your donors are. And if you look at their, you look at a bill and you see who the main sponsor of that bill is or who the co-sponsors are, and you look at who got whether they got a donation from a company or entity that has something to do with the bill that they're passing or trying to get passed, then you can, move your way from there. Also, if you're covering utilities, the utility commissions, they have these things called consumer sessions, and anybody can send in comments about the utility rate change. And a lot of big companies will add comments to that. Like one recently for us, there was a utility rate change for the Southwest Gas Authority, and there was lots of comments by Google, who was very interested in the energy development that they were proposing and everything. So if you look at just public records, you'll see that there's a lot of information on who's pushing what, and they say it right there, why.
Depending on your state, in California, there's a Ledge Info. It's a website you can go to, plug the bill in. And as the bill moves its way through various committees, there's an analysis. They do financial impact. And it also says who's for it and against it. And that's where you start, because there's, again, the money part. But that analysis is very helpful. And if they're amenable, the staff, it's a legislative staff, or the committee staff that promulgated the report might talk to you about it. But that's, so it's kind of a nonpartisan step back. This bill would do that and benefit so-and-so, and that's a good way to find out what's going on.
Lucky you. I always go straight to lobbying filings to try to at least start answering this question, but our lobbying filings don't tell you whether a party is for or against. They just tell you that they lobbied on it. So then to get them to actually tell you what their position was is a whole other layer. Anyway, all right. Thank you so much. Oh, okay. Please.
Nice.
Beautiful tips. Great way to close. So thank you so much, everyone. This has been really fun. Thank you all for coming. And I hope we can stay in touch. I started a group on the HUVA, suggesting that maybe some of us could stay in touch, you know, kind of figure out some kind of informal network for those of us who are covering stuff at the state level, continue to trade these kinds of tips. So if anyone's interested, obviously feel free to come chat now or, you know, hit me up on HUVA or, you know, I'd love to figure out some way to stay in touch. So, yeah, thank you all for coming.